Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Happy Wednesday. Today is May 13th, 2015. I'm Michelle Fiché, filling in for Jeannie, and I'm here today with Dr. Michael Rice. We warmly welcome you to the show, and thank you for choosing to be with us. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk with our host. We encourage you to call in with your comments or questions, allowing you to actively strengthen and deepen your practice. So now, let's welcome Michael in support of developing our inner process of Aramaic forgiveness.
Well, thank you, young lady. Appreciate you taking care of the switchboard today. We're kind of out here in the boonies where there's no internet connection, but I do have a cell phone signal, and hopefully the signal's strong enough and clear enough that we'll be able to carry forward the show. We tested a little earlier, and it seems like it is. We're actually getting a little bit of playtime in after that 20-day intensive and the last weeks we've been on the road. It's nice to just get some quiet time here. So we're at a place called Blue Springs, where they have this huge, oh, probably 40-foot diameter blue hole that comes up out of the ground, and this water just welling up, this blue-green. Looks like we're in the Caribbean, so it's pretty cool. And the temperature's perfect. It's probably about 82, 83 degrees, sunny, absolutely beautiful day. Calling for rain a little later, but so we decided to get our playtime in early this morning. And that's what we're doing here. And last night we got to do, you know, one of the things we do when we're traveling in a 20-day intensive, there's not much time for movies, but that's our relaxed time. And I saw an interesting film last night, Water Diviner, if you haven't seen it, with Russell Crowe. It's pretty powerful vision and view of some of the insanity of the world. As this man is in Australia, and he's a water diviner, and that means he takes a pair of metal rods and goes out looking for water and actually is able to find it. And, you know, they show him digging a well, and it's all pretty cool. And his sons, being kind of gung-ho, decide, this is pre-World War I, his sons decide to go off to war. And it's just a really powerful bird's-eye view of the insanity of what, because people can manufacture arms, we do to each other. It's just a thing to really hold a space for. It's interesting. It's pretty graphic, round after round of people pulling out their rifles and their bayonets, and it's like, and this is service, and then they pull out their cannons and shoot this little town all to heck, and the peasants are all, you know, wandering away homeless. And, oh, here they are. They're going to do more service. Look at this service. And it's interesting that we've been taught to use that word as a metaphor for, sadly enough, killing people and stealing their land. It's interesting, a couple of interesting scenes in the film where this man's from Australia, and he's in Gallipoli looking for his children. He's able to, it shows the intuitive faculty functioning in a pretty interesting way, but he's able in a battlefield that's sealed off by the Brits, where they've killed about 7,000 locals, and 3,000 of their own men have been killed. So it's just a huge burial ground, and this man is able to go in and find the bodies of two of his children. And the battle he has to go through in order to get his children. And ostensibly take them back home with him, and then he finds a son that's still alive. And the trauma and the horror that he's been through. It's certainly a movie where you have to breathe. There is definitely room for worksheets in it. And the son was charged by his father as they went off to war. This is the oldest son. Well, you take care of your younger brothers. And both of his younger brothers die. So, of course, he's in guilt. And, you know, I didn't do it, Dad. I killed them. And interesting that the father finally has the insight that, no, I raised them on this fallacy of war and conflict, and I killed them. And when we start looking, it's a tough thing to look at in a culture that thinks war is normal, oftentimes holy, and of course every time right. But it gives a view of the insane side of that whole process. And of course, it's all just a reflection. You can go back all the way to the book of James, and they say to James, from whence come the wars and fightings among you? And he says, basically, from the unresolved issues in your own mind. And so the biggest contribution that we can make is to resolve those issues in our own minds about how things in our lives are somebody else's fault, to just shortcut this game that ultimate, the end game is somebody's got to kill somebody. There's an interesting scene where the Turkish general is befriended, and the general is one who gave the order for his sons to be killed, but he ends up befriending him, and the general helps him look for his sons, and they connect. And at one point, the general says, "Well, you know, what did Australia get of our land?" And then, you know, they're talking about the Ottoman Empire and how it was the largest empire on the face of the earth, and how it was carved up, and who took what as a result of this service. And he asks this fellow from Australia, "Well, what did Australia get? Whose land did Australia get?" And the fellow, Russell Crowe, plays the character, says, "Well, you know, we didn't get anything. We fought for principle." And the general just looks at him. It's like, so the principle was, you fight, you die, or your sons die, and the Brits get your land, your share of it. You don't even get a share. You know, and it's like, it just is a bird's eye view of the oldest reason for why we do what we do in the insane world of hostility and fear, where somebody else is to blame, and there's no human life left. And so one of the projects that we're working toward is bringing human life, bringing the active presence of love into the circles of insanity that exist on our earth. And our definition of insanity isn't quite the same as the world's definition. Our definition of insanity in this work is, if my mind isn't functioning with the presence of love, then I'm insane. And in that insane place, I'll do or say or do the behaviors that are structured within my carbon-based memory with no regard for whether or not I am damaging another, whether or not I am damaging myself, or what I'm doing. It's just, you know, automatic decision system kicks in, and the mind takes over, and it does whatever it's been brainwashed to do when we're disconnected from love. And so to be restored to sanity is to be restored to a mind that can empower us to choose differently than conflict and rage and hate and fear and murder in order to achieve the king's goals. And of course, kings love it when people stay stupid and do whatever they're told. And this is a powerful demonstration of it. And so many young men who, you know, Russell Crowe says, "Yeah, I trained my children in this insanity of God and country." And when it's time to wake up, you start realizing that no one has ever raised a rifle for God. That's just a plain, simple fraud and a lie. Love would never condone. You know, if love were standing here, the Creator were standing here, he'd say, "Are you crazy? You're going to raise a gun? You've got to be nuts." And you're going to raise a gun against one of the other cells in your body and mercilessly slaughter and snuff out that life that has a mother at home, has a father at home, has children, has a spouse, has brothers, have sisters. The Creator would never condone such an insane idea. And of course, kings, well, they like to have land, they like to have power, they like to have possession of natural resources, and so you'll notice that where there are no natural resources to be had, not many people go there to make war. But, oh, we got all kinds of reasons when there's something there of value. And so we just invite everybody to look into that in your own heart. And if there's conflict there, then we invite you to engage in the first century Aramaic idea of forgiveness. Go inside yourself and remove that conflict so you have a clear mind as to what it's about. And a clear mind that starts with a human life, that starts with an act of connection to love. And our definition, of course, in this work of a human life is very simple. Hold a newborn child, you know exactly what a human being is. And when we recognize that we are designed to function as the active presence of love, then the only possible route to follow is to dissolve the insanity, the rage, the guilt, the grief, the fear on every side of the equation and bring the presence of love, which is the only thing that will heal. You know, you can't kill enough enemies to get rid of them, but you can stand as a space of love and bring healing. And when enough people will do that, then we'll change the whole game on planet Earth. And that's one of the things we're here to support. You know, let's end this divorce game. Let's end this father, son, mother, daughter, separated and enraged with each other. You know, I run into so many parents who, my children haven't spoken to me in years. I have no relationship with my son or my daughter. And it's like, well, you know, time for resolution, time for healing. And so we're here with tools from the first century Aramaic language. And if you are not familiar with the tool of forgiveness, it is a tool for going inside of yourself and removing literally your very capacity for any form of hostility or fear. How would life look? How would your family system look if never in all the years that you were with your spouse and your children, physiology could never have produced anything based in hostility or fear? What if your spouse had been totally, completely incapable of producing any form of hostility or fear? What if you raised your children in a world where they did not know what hostility and fear was? Now, as John Lennon said, you may say, I'm a dreamer. Fortunately, I'm not the only one. There are more people and more people every day getting on board, recognizing, this game can be changed. And the change starts inside of me. And it starts with first century Aramaic forgiveness, the opposite of what this culture teaches. Forgiveness has nothing to do with me letting you off the hook for what's going on inside of me. Forgiveness is the tool with which I go inside myself and I remove my rage, my guilt, my grief, my fear, my pain, my drama, my trauma. And I start to see through different eyes. And when I start to see through different eyes, you know, let me see, what's the name of the author that, Marcel Proust. The goal is not to discover new landscape, but to see with new eyes. And when I recognize that I don't have a set of windows that look out on the world, I have a set of eyes, and I paint every picture that appears on the inside of those eyeballs, and I pretend that it's a picture of something outside of me. And I say things like, well, you know, they really enraged me. But, of course, rage is something that's going on inside of me. How could someone else possibly cause that in you? It's not even logical. It's not sensible. You know, the person you say enrages you, perhaps you haven't seen them for years, and you still say, they enrage me. What an insane way to think. When I think in terms of someone else causing something to happen inside of me, then the very thing, the painful thing that I need to resolve, I've now hidden from myself. I've dissociated from. There was a story a couple of years back about a gentleman who was in his late 60s, early 70s, I don't remember exactly, and he was at the point where he couldn't drive anymore, but he heard about his brother who he'd been estranged from for, I don't know, 30 years or 40 years, 50 years, whatever it was. I don't remember the details. But when he heard about his brother having cancer and going to die, he didn't have much money. And so what he did is he got his riding lawnmower fixed. I believe he lived in Ohio. And he literally drove from Ohio to California on his riding lawnmower to see his brother. And when they saw each other, neither of them could remember what it was that they had used as an excuse to stop communicating with each other for decades and decades and decades. And, you know, this gentleman, when he hears his brother's dying, human life shows up, he fixes up his lawnmower and he drives to the other side. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, that'd be like a covered wagon kind of journey. And he can't remember why they wouldn't they stop speaking, neither of them. What's really important in our world, and how do we remove the things that are unimportant, the rages, the guilts, the griefs, the fears that we blame others for? If you haven't yet had access to that technology, we invite you to go to our website, www.whyagain.org. And in the middle of the page, you'll see a bullseye. Follow the links. It'll take you into everything you need to know, right down to the last detail of how forgiveness works. It is not what you think it is. Forgiveness, suffice to say, has nothing to do with what the Greeks have taught us, what kings have taught us. You let somebody else off the hook for what's going on inside of you. Because when you let somebody else off the hook for what's going on inside of you, you leave intact whatever it is that's going on inside of you. And if it's intact inside of you, I guarantee you're going to get to live the title of my book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Only you'll probably say it slightly differently. You'll say, why are they doing this to me again? And when I engage in forgiveness, I stop doing those things to myself. I stop blaming other people for those things. And I break through generations and generations and generations of insanity. And I get to live as a human being. I get to incarnate and embody the active presence of love in my physiology. What an awesome, awesome thing it is to watch that happen and to get to participate with people all over the globe as they do that. We had a young lady in Tehran, Iran right now, or back about 3 years ago, who found our worksheet online, started doing it, changed her life, and asked, she said, we have nothing like that here. Can I translate your book into Farsi? And so now the book is in Farsi, and the tool of forgiveness, as it was taught 2,000 years ago, is there and available. It's just interesting to watch how it spreads around the globe as people actually start to use it and realize, my goodness, I don't need to live with this hostility or fear. They can keep doing the same stuff. It doesn't matter. My state of mind, my state of trauma or drama has nothing to do with what's going on in my world. It's got to do with the contents of my mind. Of course, the world triggers that content into activity, and I leave out the step between what happened in the world and my pain. I hide that from myself by talking in terms of denial. That made me mad, and there I leave out the step where I hold energies in me that are madness. And so what forgiveness does is gives you the opportunity to confront and remove your madness. And that's what we're here to support on planet Earth. Let's create a new game, new day. So Michelle, is Dr. Tim with us today?
He is.
Well, let's say hello to the young man. How do you be, sir? What's exciting in your world today?
I'm doing well, thank you. What's exciting is we had our Mindshifter support group last night, and so we were able to watch the 24-minute video of the PowerPoint presentation that Bill Costantino put together. And at the end of it, there were comments like, yes, and it's about time. We should have had this years ago, and that was great. So this is from people who've seen variously probably 4 or 6 different showings of the Why Is This Happening to Me Again video, and several of them have seen you live. So tremendous response to the 24-minute PowerPoint video on YouTube. And the discussion that went on from there was a full half hour, and then there were time for 2 separate worksheets, and both were beautiful worksheets. Difficult to pinpoint what the target should be, what the emotions should be, and how I get to the goal that's going to satisfy those. And so some of the finer points of the worksheet process got unveiled and worked through. And it was just a marvelous group. And again, hats off to Bill for that job and to you for presenting the work so much with such clarity over the years that he could then distill it down into that 24-minute video, which was just a joy to watch. And as we've talked about so many times, it's It resonates the joy in me when I see people getting it at deeper levels. So that's what's new with me.
Well, that's awesome. And, you know, it's really fabulous that Bill stepped up to the plate and said, I know how to do PowerPoint. I can put this in a way that works. And after many hours of consultation, just slid it all together, a couple of refinements, and it's pretty awesome. And by the way, if you think we should have had that years ago, then I invite you to participate. I invite you to do a part in, you know, we could easily, over the next 6 months, use 10,000 hours of time and $5 million to bring forward all the things that we could have had, should have had, would have had years ago. But, you know, Jeannie and I are two people. Tim's one person. Michelle's a person. Rex is a person. And each one is doing something about it. What's your part? What can you do? What resources do you have that you can lend to the work so that you can say, yeah, this should have been available 8 years ago, 10 years ago, and I can help make the next tool available in a new way. Got the skills, got the time, got the money, be part of it. It's always easy for people to sit back and say, oh, you know, that should have. Well, okay, so I call you out and invite you to participate and help to make it happen. Because literally, we have all kinds of plates spinning. You know, I oftentimes compare myself to the guy at the circus who's spinning the plates, and you spin as many plates as you can, and you keep them all spinning, and then you start another one, and then you start another one, and, you know, keeping up with them all is sometimes an interesting challenge, and I get to do worksheets about it and move forward in my process. And so I just invite everybody who has a resource that you'd like to lend to taking it to the next level. And I mean, literally, we could use 10,000 hours of skilled help in many arenas, from Heartland and helping to get buildings in shape for the summer. And actually, we had a roof go down two winters ago now with a snow overload, and that roof is still down on one of our storage buildings. It just takes the resources, the time, intelligence, money, and energy. So if you've got some time, intelligence, money, and energy to add to and see the value of this, then get on the team and do it. And that will be much appreciated by, of course, everybody that's involved in the work, but even more appreciated by everybody who gets touched by what your contribution is. It was just fabulous for Bill to step forward and say, well, you know, I'm a trainer. I've done PowerPoints before that are really awesome. Can I do this? It's like, please, let's go for it. So pretty sweet, pretty awesome. So, Michelle, do we have anybody with a hand up or anybody in the phone queue with a question for us?
No, both are quiet.
In the chat room?
No, chat room is very quiet. And when people are guests, they can't really share comments. So no comments and nobody with a hand up.
Okay. Well, if Brenda's there, I'd love to hear how, if you're there, Brenda, how the input yesterday fit for you on your question about the filters, and if that really filled out the questions you were asking, or if there are any other refinements. I would love to hear your thoughts on that, on the filter system as it's taught in the Aramaic. It was interesting. We were out in California a few years back, and it was actually in a Laws of Living class at Heartland that we really refined and discovered, or rediscovered, the meaning of the word rachma and how it applied, and in real practical terms, what it was and how it worked. And a few years back, we were out in California, and there's a community there that speaks Aramaic as their native language. It was fun to have them read from the manuscript. And when we discussed this word rachma, when we asked about rachma, the response was, we don't know what the word means anymore. The meaning has been lost. But their tradition said that it was the most precious jewel you could possibly have. And when you realize that it is literally a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that keeps your mind on track and is a gateway for love, for human life to enter human form, you know, if you watch people, you can watch them flip from minute to minute to minute through these different filters. You know, the woman who is abused You know, she's 5 foot two. Her husband's 6 foot nine, beats her every day. She looks at him through the fear filter. So the only thing she can see is something threatening about him. You know, maybe you were the person who helped her get out. Maybe you got her to the battered woman's shelter and went and visited her every day and supported her. And after 2 weeks, when the fear filter had decayed away in its activity, what did she say to you? She said, and I've heard this 1,000 times, I want to go back because I love him. When the fear filter had decayed away over time, it had quieted down, then she could no longer see what was threatening about him. And she went back. It took her about 2 minutes for that filter to be activated again, and she remembered exactly why she needed to get out. But you'll know that you'll notice there's a point where we'll say, well, something snapped in her mind. She's 5 foot two, and she goes after this guy tooth and claw, and he doesn't stand a chance. Nothing snapped in her mind. All that happened was she shifted filters. And when she shifted out of the fear filter, which only shows her what's threatening about her object of attention, she went into the hostility filter, and the hostility filter shows us what is in our minds that is irritating, resonated by this object of attention. And you don't want to get in her way when she's in that filter, because she sees nothing threatening and will take on anything or anybody. And that's what happens when those filters shift. So in a very practical, real way, you can see this in the real world. We do have one comment in our culture that kind of refers to the filters, and we say, oh, watch out for Bill, or watch out for Harry, or watch out for Mary. They got out of the bed on the wrong side this morning. What are we saying? In essence, we're saying Bill or Harry or Mary has their hostility filter set. You don't want to get in the view of that hostility filter, or they're going to be irritated at you and tend to attack. So that's what the filter system is about. And when I recognize that I can train my mind to keep Rachma active continuously, then what that filter does is it empowers me to see the good and the loving in myself and everybody that I look at. And that's the challenge to do that. Because, of course, everyone has some good, something wondrous and amazing about them. But if we only look at them through our hostility or fear filters, we can only see what's threatening or irritating. And the person who we see as threatening or irritating, we call them enemy. And we think that what we need to do is destroy them, when what we need to do is shift filters and open a different level or a different type of communication with them. And when that happens, the whole game changes. And so, you know, how often have we heard of somebody, or maybe we've been the person who you look at this object of attention, your love filters are set, and you, I love you, I cherish you, I will honor you forever. And then they give you the look. And what happens when they give you the look? Filter shift. And then the person that 30 seconds earlier we were saying, I love you, I cherish you, I honor you, all of a sudden it's, don't touch me, don't come near me, I never want to see you again. What just happened? Same two people, they're in the same room, same circumstance. The only thing that intervened was the look, and the look resonated a filter, and seeing through a different filter, we go from love to hate. And, or at least what appears to be love, to hate. And, you know, it's just wake up time and start to take charge of our own filtering system rather than leave it to whoever's being triggered in the world. You go back to Yeshua, and in essence he says, hey, I'm in this world. I'm here with you, but I'm not playing the games you are, because I'm not of this world. This world doesn't set my filters. I do it. And so I have a different kind of connection. You can do this too. And half of his listeners that heard that were like, yeah, I'm out of here. That's too hard a saying. I can't take that level of responsibility. And sadly, a lot of people, when you introduce them to actually taking responsibility for their lives and working through what they need to work through, are like, no, not me. I'm out of here. I'm finished. And that's just part of the process. Over time, when one has the brain cells, one comes to the point where they go, oh, I see. The fact that I've been through this particular experience 87 different times with 42 different people means it's about me. It's mine. It's inside. Oh, I see. Okay, cool. And now I can start to move through those things. I don't know. We've got somebody maybe could mute their phone. There's a lot of banging and knocking around going on in the background.
Michael, you asked to talk to Brenda, and so I think she's on the line here.
Awesome. Hey there, young lady. Welcome.
Hi there. It was probably me doing my dishes.
Okay.
Anyway, yesterday, sorry, my phone kind of ran out of power, and I wanted to thank Dr. Kim when we kind of lost you in the middle of the conversation, and then Dr. Kim took over. And that was really helpful, Dr. Kim. It gave me some clarity. And so I'm going to give back what I gained from it, and then the two of you can let me know if I'm on the right track. I'm getting the idea that you can have multiple intentions, but until you take those intentions and actually set them as a goal, the instructions, directions, intuition, if you want to call it whatever, the knowledge to accomplish those intentions do not really surface. They do not surface in a coordinated way to assist you in meeting that goal. So that made it a lot clearer for me to understand that I have many intentions, but need to filter those down, or want to filter those down, into specific goals. And that's why it's important that I find out what my most important and longest-term intentions are so that I can establish the short-term goals. I've been working with the mind management worksheet, and that has been very helpful. Now, I want to shift to... Okay, let me stop there, and then I'll ask the question on procrastination. I'll wait for comments.
I didn't hear your last comment, Brenda.
Oh, I just said I'll have another question on procrastination, but right now I'm going to have you and Dr. Kim just kind of let me know if I'm going down the right rabbit hole with this and getting a good comprehension of it.
I think you've got it, Dr. Kim.
Yeah, I think she's got it. I don't have anything to add.
Okay, well, great.
You're on track.
Let me get back to the issue of procrastination. Because I think I've always been thinking, or I have subconsciously been thinking of my intentions, which are multiple, as goals. And therefore, when I don't accomplish the intention, then I would go into guilt, paralysis in that I had not accomplished them. Even though many times when I didn't accomplish the intention that I had, I found out later that had I accomplished it, it would have made things worse rather than better. So looking backwards at not procrastinating on an intention actually turned out to be a benefit. So now I'd like to address the issue of procrastination. Once you set a goal, then does the mind open up for procrastination, or does the action of setting that goal now, lessen or weaken that tendency to procrastinate?
Yeah. If you think about the day or days where you tend to procrastinate, you'll notice that if you looked at your to-do list, it was longer than could possibly be achieved. And there's an easy way to understand procrastination through the computer world. Notice if you open your computer and you open one program, it zips right along and works very well. You open two programs, it does just fine. You open three, you're rocking. You open four, well, it's still working. Things are slowing down a little bit. You open five, and they're slowing even more. Six, seven, eight, nine, ten. You get 15 programs open, and all of a sudden the computer starts to hang up. It slows down. It takes, a minute to move from one program to another. You hit your a letter on the keyboard, and it takes 30 seconds for the letter to appear, and then finally the computer crashes. That's procrastination. Basically, all of the resources are used up on the computer, and the computer can't function. The mind is no different. If you go back to the ancient Aramaic, you hear Yeshua saying the words that at least the Greeks translate, sufficient for the day are the evils thereof. And you wouldn't know that he was talking about goal setting and procrastination with that thought, but that's exactly what he was talking about. And the sufficient for the day are the evils. That word evil in Aramaic can be translated two ways as relates to sin, which is an archery term. When you fire at the target and you miss the bullseye, the scorekeeper yells sin. And so when I miss the bullseye, I'm off the mark. That's sin. If I miss the target altogether, that in Aramaic is evil. But there's a second meaning for the word evil, and that is like a piece of fruit is unripened or incomplete. It would be referred to as evil. So when you hear the ancient teaching saying we're all evil, that's accurate if you've got the right definition of the word. None of us is finished. We're all in process. And so in that sense, we are evil. And as Yeshua was using that term in sufficient for the day are the evils thereof, what he's saying in essence is set no more goals than what you can achieve reasonably in the next waking period, or you will overload your mind with stress and your mind will shut down. And so procrastination is nothing more than the resources of the mind are overloaded, and just like the computer, it crashes. So there are only two ways to relieve the stress of a goal. And the way you create stress is by setting goals. The only two ways you can relieve the stress of a goal is either by canceling the goal or achieving the goal. So if you never, if the world never taught you to cancel goals, you went to the goal setting workshop and you were all excited and they told you how to set your daily goals and your weekly goals and your monthly goals and your 5-year goals and your 10-year goals and your 20-year goals and your lifetime goals, you came back so overloaded with stress it wasn't funny. And if you never cancel all of those goals, then your mind is constantly using its resources to try to take care of those things. Cancel all of your goals beyond the next 24 hours. Well, actually, right now, it's we're almost at 2 o'clock here. So cancel all your goals for the next anything except for the next 8 hours. Cancel every goal you've got. And then if there's something you want to accomplish next year, then put it in your planner. Don't set a goal for it. You'll create a stress and you won't be able to do anything about that stress, and you'll be overloaded. So
that would
plan for those things that go beyond the next waking period and only set goals that you can reasonably achieve, and then you'll have all the resources you need available to you to achieve those goals.
Well, I did find that while I was doing the goal management worksheet, and I kind of slacked off a little bit lately, but I will get back to it. I plan to get back to it. Today.
Good.
But I think
awesome.
Part of the reason that I went, or I let it slide a little bit, although I noticed that when I limited myself to 4 goals, that I pretty much accomplished them. However, I made my goals, in other words, I set a time and space to do computer work. And whatever, without specifying exactly what computer work, and then the time for myself, a goal was setting aside time for myself, and that would be the choices of different things that I could do. So it was more like setting a general goal in 4 different categories.
With right.
A little open with multiple possibilities within those goals, and sometimes I didn't achieve harsh parts of those additional abilities, but I did meet the overall goal in at least one of
right.
the
And that's why each night before you go to bed with the Mind Goal Management Sheet, you cancel all your goals. You cancel all your goals from your whole life. You ask to be guided. Am I holding any goals for my dad when I was a kid? Am I holding any goals for my mom, for myself, for my education, for my spiritual life, for church, for my body, for relationships, for college? Have I got goals in there that I set, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago that I haven't canceled yet, then I want to cancel those, or that stress is still there underlying and using resources. In Laws of Living, we do get into a more refined planning sheet than the Mind Goal Management Sheet, and actually setting goals in, or setting up each area of your life and what's important, and framing goals for those areas, and then in appropriate time frames, setting those goals. So it sounds like you've kind of intuited to that one.
Well, that's what I'm moving to now. One of the major goals that I believe I have canceled, although every once in a while it raises its head, but I'm able to notice it immediately, pretty quickly, and then cancel that, and that's the need to rescue the world, because boy, talk about a lot of intentions involved in that one. And
your voice cut out a little bit there, at least my headset did. Tell me again what that was.
The goal on rescuing the world.
Okay. Yeah, that's a pretty big one. I it's my responsibility to fix the whole world, and I have to do it today.
Right.
Yeah, you know, there's an old question that gets asked, and that is, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And if you have a goal that's that big to impact the world, then you better be breaking it down into bite-sized chunks. What can I do today? Otherwise, if I take the whole thing on, my mind will be so overwhelmed with stress, I won't be able to do anything about it. And sadly, that's what a lot of people with good intentions do. You might remember the ancient said, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We can have all the good intentions in the world, but it's when we get it down to a goal, and goals that we can actually achieve within the next waking period, that we're actually going to make progress toward that bigger plan of what can I do to support the world in healing.
Well, one of the things that has passed away with my goal, I guess, of releasing the world to take care of itself and to focus on my own mind thought in regards to the world has been a release of guilt. And I can now so much more easily, and almost in every instance, when a choice comes in my mind, to say to myself, no, this is not the goal that I have of releasing the world to itself. And it's okay for me not to rescue this person, this thing, or such at this moment. And it's much easier now for me to do that. And I just don't feel any guilt about it, which is a big, big step, because, oh my gosh, I was raised in the missionary guild.
So my input would be that you might want to do some worksheets around guilt at not saving the world.
Yes.
The language, you know, comes from a place where there's still some brain cells with guilt, so you might want to free that energy up with some worksheets and
mm-hmm.
let go of guilt.
I think that is the case. And although it's getting more and more difficult for me to, or I'm noticing, I guess, it's not difficult, I'm having greater joy in recognizing when it doesn't rise in different situations.
Right.
And I guess maybe because now this was a piece of decision. So whether there is a flashback of guilt, and I guess maybe that's what you're saying, is that there may be some conscious going, oh, well, I've released guilt, but I'm still thinking about the fact that I've released it.
Well, and, you know, it might go back to me being 10 years old and hearing a very rousing sermon from someone who was, quote unquote, thinking they were saving the world, and, you know, maybe doing it with fear and guilt and telling you that you had to do the same. And as that innocent 10-year-old saying, well, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and I'm going to do that. And again, once the goal is set in the mind, there are only two ways to get rid of it. It's either got to be achieved or canceled. And then, you know, and then if someone, you know, had this installation of guilt, well, and if you don't do what I'm telling you to do, then there's something wrong with you. And, you know, self-deprecating thoughts, which is pretty popular, sadly, in the religious world or so-called religious world, then that's the kind of thing that you want to do worksheets and, you know, ferret that stuff out and remove those energies, because they will just interfere with and use up the energies that you have for doing your part in whatever it is that you're here to bring to the world. And you might, I think you've got the videos, and you might in this context watch the video, Getting the Stress You Need. That's where we address this issue, and you'll probably find that useful to this whole conversation.
It would. And I guess what I wanted to present, maybe I did well, is that I'm noticing that that feeling is not arising anymore. It's like
cool.
It's not when I say no to something or say that's not my responsibility. I don't feel any guilt attached to that as I formerly did.
Yeah.
So, but are you saying because I'm mentioning the word guilt in this particular conversation that I guess that's what I'm getting lost?
Shakespeare said, my words fly up, my thoughts remain below. And so I hear you saying guilt is not arising, but you wouldn't be talking about guilt if there wasn't guilt under the surface. It may not be arising. It sounds like you've, you know, chopped off the top levels, but I'd suggest a few more worksheets might show you that there's a deeper part where that guilt has been instilled, and when you let go of it freely, then just automatic conversation will look more like, well, you know, when the world is tugging on my heartstrings and I'm thinking that I'm supposed to, my old programming says I'm supposed to fix it, I feel really good about just sitting down, taking a deep breath, tapping into the presence of love, and sending love to the world instead of going out and fixing it for everybody. So that would be more spontaneous speech as opposed to, well, I don't have any guilt. That says that under the surface, although the guilt isn't coming to the surface, that the words are coming from those brain cells. So there might, it might be worth looking at and doing a little more work in that arena. That's all.
Okay, well, you answered my next question then was, because the way you stated it is the way I intended. That is the way that I feel. The way you stated it is the way I feel.
Yeah.
And so that would
be So my input is that in your surface mind, I hear you, and I agree with that's where it's going. But the fact that the words about guilt slide into the conversation says there's probably a little more work to do under the surface. You know, when you recognize, you know, the generally accepted number is, you know, something like 90% to 95% of what goes on in the mind is unconscious. If I watch carefully my words, it will tell me what's happening in my unconscious. So my surface mind may say, yeah, I'm in delight and peace and it's all cool, but if what I'm speaking about is how I'm not guilty, then the hidden part of the mind is still holding that frequency, otherwise those words wouldn't come forward. You know, let's say, you know, we're going to leave here on Saturday morning and drive to Atlanta. And what would be the only reason that I would say I'm not driving to Memphis on Friday or Saturday? It would only be because somewhere in brain cells is the idea of driving to Memphis is firing. Otherwise, there'd be no reason to, you know, I mean, there are 8 billion places on the planet I could talk about why I'm not going there. Why am I talking about not going to Memphis? Because those are the brain cells that are firing somewhere under the surface. And so if I just watch my words, then my words will indicate what's happening in that hidden part of the mind, and they'll give me a clue that can help me to go in and ferret out things that I'd rather not be carrying around in that unconscious.
Right, well, I'm
Dr.
fully
Kim,
aware.
Do you have any thoughts in that direction?
Well, only to say that it is a very useful tool. And one of the ways that you're explaining it now is sounding to my ear slightly different than you have in the past, which is, I think, going to be a little easier for some people to hear when they used to get upset about regulatory speech. I'm acknowledging that work has been done. I'm acknowledging that I don't get as upset as I used to. However, if I'm still using the word guilt, there's a deeper level of my mind that's resonating that energy. And if I just use it, it's like you were talking about, you know, the guy who used a divining rod to find water in that movie. If I use my regulatory speech that way, it will point me toward where I still have work to do. And, of course, until I learn about this process and have it described to me the way you're describing it now, I don't have access to that tool. But once I learn about it, once I have the willingness to open up to it and explore it, I might just find that it's a very useful tool and that my speech will absolutely reveal to me my next level of work. You still there?
Oh, yeah.
That makes sense, Brenda?
Right. Yes, I'm still here. I'm listening. I guess that takes me. Okay. And I am currently doing multiple worksheets on guilt for other areas or moving forward. So I am fully aware that there are layers and layers and layers of guilt down there that I'm not even aware of. I guess my next question, in taking what you and Dr. Tim have said, is in explaining to somebody a change in recognizing something, then I have to learn to explain that change without actually specifically naming the change.
I'm not sure what that means.
Well, and I guess I'm not quite sure what you mean, Jevon, because it sounds like, you know, your explanation, you know, the way, and I said that's exactly the proper, the way that I choose and will go forward in saying it. My next thing was but that statement doesn't reflect to, does not send somebody else the message that there has been a change from this to this, if I can't mention the word, the initial word.
Let me just say that, Brenda, what it sounds like you're trying to do here is you're trying to get it right with what you say. And let me encourage you to let go of getting it right. Because that would be trying to hide from yourself what your unconscious mind is showing you. So it isn't about, all right, tell me how to say it. You said it just fine. You got the point across that you have effectively done a lot of work to get rid of some guilt.
Right.
Good, and congratulations. And you might want to notice there might be deeper levels of guilt still resonating.
Correct.
So this isn't a criticism of the way you're speaking, and it's not a criticism of the work you've done. It's an acknowledgement of the work you've done, and it's an acknowledgement of a further refinement and a tool in your speech that might lead you, not anybody else, to know what else, other work you have to do, but would lead you to know where you might do another level of your own work. So when you say, all right, so now I have to talk about things without mentioning this word or that word, now you've completely missed the point of this useful tool. The useful tool is there to reveal to you where you might still have some work to do. And if I decide, you know what, I really don't want to do any more work on this, that's my choice. If I decide I really just want to hide from myself the fact that I might still have work to do, that's also my choice.
And I might be complete with the issue. But if I pay attention to my speech, then my speech will often inform me about a part of my mind that I'm not acquainted with at the moment. And so it can just be useful to follow that and just see where it goes. And if you follow it and it doesn't go anywhere, then okay, I'm complete with that. That's cool. But more often than not, over the years, what I've found is that when you feed people back their speech, that it tells them something they don't know about themselves. And again, as Dr. Tim says, you know, oftentimes people will say, well, then how do I say it the right way? There is no right way to say it. It's about how do I heal the parts of my mind that hold things that I want to be finished with, and then I'll spontaneously speak and reflect what's true there. And every word tells me something true about the content of my mind. And if the word don't precedes it, then it's probably something that, you know, I'm sort of hiding from myself. So, you know, just do a worksheet or two and see if in that particular arena it takes you deeper. And you might find that it does, and you might find that it's something you're already complete with. And that's cool. I know you've been working diligently for many years. I acknowledge you. I don't see many people who have the willingness and the stick-to-itness that you have.
Well, I am fully aware that there are multiple numbers yet to get. I shall do that. And I thank you for
cool.
the input.
Awesome. And awesome. Well, anything else we can support you with today?
No, I think the main thing was the whole purpose of my question was on the intentions and goals, and we kind of got off track about that a little bit. So I am, how do we get back on track with the intentions and goals? I had another question, but it's now not at surfacing at the top of my mind. So anyway, what I will do is I will take the input from today and go forward with that, and also work with the goal mind management sheet with this new understanding that I have in regard to the intuitions as multiple intuitions, and that those are the
right.
things that you actually procrastinate with, and that goals are much, much fewer and are less and less, are much more successful.
Great.
All right. Well, you
awesome.
Guys have a great
Let me,
day. And I'll see you later.
It's in the plan. It's in the plan.
Bye-bye.
We're down to just a minute or two, but I'm just going to throw out an analogy that might be useful again around the idea of intentions versus perception versus goals. So I have a set of raw. I want to build a building. I have a set of raw materials. I have bricks. I have boards. I have glass. I have windows. I have wiring. I have sinks. I have toilets. I got all these raw materials. There are my intentions. And now I'm going to get out the blueprint. And if I have a blueprint that's really precise and concise and I've got all the materials, then my perceptual mind is going to tap in. It's going to organize those things into a picture in my mind, a finished product. And so it is my blueprint, my goal, that actually allows me to take the raw materials and then turn them into a finished product. RAKMA is a way to make sure that all your raw materials are first quality. KRUMA is a way to make sure that your blueprint is going perfectly from the ideal picture into the ideal behavior driving reality that the mind produces to guide behavior. So maybe that would help to make that a little clearer, and we are down to just the last few seconds, so I'm going to invite everybody to create the best year yet of your eternal lives. It's an awesome gift to give the world, and bring a stranger to the show tomorrow, and if you're ready to take your work to the next level, we're getting set up. Things are starting to crank for Heartland starting in July. We'll be doing a food fund forgiveness, and then starting out with a 9-day why, a 16-day codependence communication practicum, 16-day teacher training. Jeannie will be doing an 8-day healing the whole woman. So we're going to have a hot summer at Heartland this summer. Join us. And you can see the schedule on whyagain.org. Blessings. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com. www.whyagain.com.
Evolving continuously.